This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Thank you, Aaron. I'm delighted to be here in Philadelphia tonight to tell you all about my experiences at the New Society. To speak louder. Okay, I'm going to be reading from some notes because I don't want to miss anything. So I hope you'll bear with that. I noticed some familiar faces in the audience. I'm very pleased that some of our members have come down from Athol Springs. And I recognize faces of others who have heard me speak in New York City, and even some of those people who have supported us on the web. So thank you for being here. And there are, of course, many faces that I don't recognize. Before I begin, I need to tell you that for those who have come specifically because of their interest in the Michelson-Morley experiment, in magnetic fossils from Mars, in Morgan's Revolt of the Bees, and the lottery as an instrument of education, these topics will be discussed not tonight, but in Athol Springs on successive Saturdays in March at 2 p.m. The lectures will take place in the amphitheater. What I'm going to show you tonight are slides taken from my photographs that document the estate in Athol Springs and the activities that take place at the New Society. And I have permission to read two or three case histories, time permitting. In 2001, I became the archivist, an official photographer for the New Society. I'm a teacher, I was a painter, but I've given up painting altogether. This has become my obsession, my project. I learned about the New Society by chance in February 2000. Some friends invited me to spend a weekend with them in their new house in Buffalo, New York. They both teach at SUNY Buffalo. On Saturday in February, we were sitting and in their kitchen reading the local alternative newspaper, Ananova. And in it, there was a report by a local writer, Jay Simpson, about a new community recently founded on County Route 101 in nearby Athol Springs, a mere 8 miles away. Here are some of what he said. It's a bit long, but I think it's worth quoting because it will contextualize this project for you. We live in a network of institutional settings, each one with its own rules, goals, and rewards, the ensemble of which mediate our existential reality. The cumulative effect has long been identified under the rubric of alienation, for which the corporate institutional power brokers have supplied their own palliative, epitomized in the term spectacle, whose main manifestation has been television. For many, however, the existential pain is too strong. Small coterie of these seekers have come together around the charismatic figure of Dr. F.A. Mesmer, who has established a therapeutic community expanding and updating the principles of her illustrious 18th century eponym, Franz Anton Mesmer, whose theories inspired the founding of the original Société de l'Harmonie Universelle. The contemporary group seeks solutions for its spiritual dislocations through the symbolically mediated magnetic treatments devised by Dr. F.A. Mesmer. They call themselves the Harmonites. Interesting, we thought. Now I have to figure out how to use this. This is also interesting. Interesting, we thought. And having little to do the next day, we took a drive to Athol Springs. After that, I visited many times alone. The New Society occupies a simple, unpretentious building on a vast 1,250-acre estate with a magnificent view of Lake Erie. Here's a patient cottage, a pasture for cows, for sheep. There are gardens, ponds, and meadows. On the grounds, I saw people tied to trees with ropes. Thank you. And I learned that Cure by the magnetized tree has a long history. Franz Anton Mesmer considered it a treatment of choice in the 18th century, as did his most important follower, the Marquis de Puysegur. Referring to his peasant, Victor Reis, whom he cured under the magnetized elm of Buzancy, his estate near Soissons, Puysegur noted in his journal of 1784, after attaching a rope to a tree, to the ropes, this actually comes from Puysegur's 1820 memoirs, disengraving the ropes. After attaching a rope to a tree, I tried its effectiveness on some sick people. The first patient came, and as soon as he had put the rope around himself, he looked at the tree and said with an air of surprise, which cannot be duplicated, "What do I see there?" Next, his head dropped, and he was in a perfect state of somnambulism. I made him eat soup that very evening, something he had not been able to do for 5 days. The phenomenon of magnetic somnambulism, which Puysegur first described as a state of consciousness where the patient is awake while sleeping, was renamed hypnotism in the 1840s by the Scottish physician James Braid, who witnessed subjects being mesmerized at stage demonstrations of animal magnetism in Manchester, where he lived. I took these photos during an electromagnetic storm, which produced excessive agitation in some guests. I learned from the staff that the Earth's regular magnetic patterns are sometimes suddenly disrupted by magnetic storms that originate in the sun, causing magnificent light displays in the sky, or alternately power outages and radiation exposure, and occasionally nervous excitation and arousal in human beings. Their bodies become receivers. We're moving inside now. It's an assembly room. A bedroom, and a glimpse at F.A. Mesmer's office. Here are snapshots of just a few of the guests taken from files. Observe the notation on the left side of some of the photos. The Harmonites are important people who lead complicated lives. They talk among themselves about matters of significance. They ask each other, "Why have we fallen out of harmony? What is the nature of existence?" They frequently cite Nicolas Burgas, Mesmer's loyal follower, who said, "We have lost almost all connection with nature. We owe almost all of the physical ailments that consume us to our institutions. We are on the brink of a great revolution." I'd like to spend a few minutes now telling you a little more about the historical origins of the new society, which I think that this audience in particular, all of you, might find very interesting. The new society is modeled after La Société de l'Harmonie Universelle, co-founded in 1783 by Nicolas Burgas. This is a photograph, rather, an engraving of Burgas. And his friend, Guillaume Corman. But it was Mesmer's theories that provided the medical basis for treatment at La Société. Here's an engraving of Franz Anton himself, which alludes underneath to the controversy surrounding his treatments. Born in 1734 in Swabia, the son of the gamekeeper to the Bishop of Constance, Mesmer studied law, then medicine, and received a doctorate at the University of Vienna, becoming in the 1770s a Viennese society doctor, and incidentally a patron of Mozart and his father Leopold. Drawing from Newtonianism and astrology, Mesmer argued in his dissertation of 1766 that the gravitational attraction of the planets played a role in human health by affecting an invisible fluid found in the human body and throughout nature. Disease was a result of obstacles in the fluid's flow throughout the body, and these obstacles could be broken by trance-like crises or convulsions, often ending in delirium, that would restore the harmony of the flow. In 1775, Mesmer revised his theory of animal gravitation to one of animal magnetism, performing his cures by using magnets to concentrate the fluid. But he eventually dispensed with mineral magnets on the grounds that nearly all substances could be magnetized by touch. And he came to think of himself as an animal magnet. Mesmer said, "Think of yourself as a magnet with your arms and especially your hands as two poles, and imagine magnetic fluid circulating from one hand to the other." Mesmer moved to Paris in 1778. Despite the skepticism of the medical community there, his treatments were wildly popular. Steeped in 18th century Newtonianism, Mesmer believed that he could create a perfect society through harmony with the physical universe. Mesmerism was as much a social movement as a medical practice, a virtual mania in pre-revolutionary France, and Mesmer, ironically, became a populist hero. He had been on good terms with Marie Antoinette, who offered support for his work, which he rejected in a public letter to the Queen. Among many others that Mesmer influenced were Danton, the Marquis de Lafayette, and Benjamin Franklin's son, Temple. In fact, the Marquis de Lafayette and Temple were two of the original charter members of the Société. On May 14, 1784, Lafayette wrote to George Washington, "A German doctor named Mesmer, having made the greatest discovery about animal magnetism, has trained some pupils, among whom your humble servant is considered one of the most enthusiastic. Before leaving, I will obtain permission to let you into Mesmer's secret life, which you can count on holds a great philosophical discovery." Here's a picture of La Société. It was an institute and clinic with branches in Paris, throughout France, in Italy, Sweden, with an outpost in Hispaniola. Mesmer himself took a strictly scientific approach, but La Société very quickly came to resemble many secret societies of that period with ties to Masonic groups and to Swedenborgians. Here are some documents from La Société. One, an illustration of political philosophy. Oh, I'm sorry. This can only go forward, so I'm just showing you more slides. Oh, an illustration of political philosophy. And another, written by Bergasse, shows his use of symbols, magic hieroglyphs, capable of communicating essential truths. This English engraving from 1794 shows the transmission of magnetic fluid from the operator to the subject. Treatment at La Société consisted of either direct contact with a patient, as you've just seen, contact through the magnetized tree, or la baquette. La baquette, a covered oak tub-like apparatus, there, containing iron filings, powdered glass, glass bottles, that could be charged with a universal fluid like a Leyden jar. Iron rods emerged and were bent at right angles. Patients were encouraged to augment the magnetic fluid by holding hands, thus creating a magnetic circuit. The woman in the background there has been seized with convulsions and is being carried into the mattress-lined crisis room. Mesmerism, or animal magnetism, was brought to America in the 1830s and had an enormous impact on 19th century medical culture. Mary Baker Eddy, the founder of Christian Science, was treated and cured by the mesmerist Phineas Quimby in the 1860s. Mesmerism was duly noted and discussed by contemporary writers Hawthorne, Emerson, Poe. It appealed to a social and philosophical strain in American thought concerning the body's effect on the mind, and a notion prevalent then that controlling sensory input could influence one's moral and intellectual constitution and perhaps even initiate a utopian order. I'm going into all this material because I'm in an academic community, and I hope that this is enlightening for you. In England and America, mesmerism and phrenology, two sciences of the mind, were linked. This is a variation of one of Mesmer's original treatments where the doctor sits with patient's knees enclosed between his own and runs his fingers all over the patient's body. Here you see the practice of interlacing the fingers of doctor and subject while grasping the thumb to enhance the transfer of magnetic fluid. The mesmerist's hands are slowly raised to draw influence out of the subject. An illustration of harmonic rapport, where one individual magnetizes another, a special connection is brought about through the harmonization of the two nervous systems. A related phenomenon was being explored in Paris at Salpêtrière, the old hospital on the lower left bank of the Seine. Here, in the 1840s, G.B. Duchenne de Boulogne, considered the first neurologist, demonstrated the relationship between facial expression and emotion by activating the muscles of the face with electricity. This photograph is titled "The Muscles of Joy and Benevolence." Comes from Duchenne's The Mechanism of Human Facial Expression, published in Paris in 1862. The muscles of lasciviousness. From the 1870s through the 1890s, while experimenting with hypnosis, Charcot and his students Fair and Louis and even Babinski employed real mineral magnets, calling their treatment metallotherapy. Charcot's Salpêtrière Doctrine of 1881 described the efficacy of mineral magnetism. Freud, when he studied with Charcot, witnessed some of these treatments, as some of you may know. Catalepsy, provoked by the sound of a tuning fork. Lethargy, woman across chairs. Lethargy resulting from the sudden extinction of light. Whoops, excuse me. Okay. At a certain point around 1885, these magnetic therapies at Salpêtrière began to conflict with research done at Nancy. Hippolyte Bernheim accused Salpêtrière investigators of having unwittingly train their subjects to transfer symptoms and to expect that such and such would occur. At that point, Bernheim believed that all of these effects could be accounted for by suggestion. These claims very, very quickly led to widespread revolt at Salpêtrière. As Genet put it later, a thunderbolt. But I should mention that Bernheim himself had carried out extensive investigations into magnetic therapy as late as 1882. Much more could be said about this fascinating chapter in early psychoanalysis, but I don't want to keep you here for too long. So let's go back to the new society. I'm going to take you into the library and play for you some of the sounds that I've heard there and read just a few notes that I took during my photographic shoots. The glass harmonica, was the musical choice of instrument of instrument was the musical was the instrument of musical was the getting a little confused. The harmony in this room is a little bit off right now, I sense. But the glass harmonica was a musical instrument of choice at La Société, but at the New Society, one hears human voices. Excuse me. Okay, open. Aaron, oh there. Okay. Can we have the next carousel, please? Actually, this isn't really. This is two tracks. I'm going to turn it off because this is two tracks. So we would need the other track. So I'll just, can you actually set it up so that the two tracks play? Seems to be, yeah. No. Let's have the other, can you put the other track on there? Just shows us one track. Okay. Oh, that's too bad. Okay. Okay, that's a shame. Magnetic interference, absolutely. Okay. Well, we're going to have to make do, won't we? The laboratory. The brain revealed. I'm going to annotate some of these slides. A mesmeric crisis. No disease can be cured without a crisis, said Franz Anton Mesmer. Taken all these photographs during a period from 2001 to 2000, and just recently to 2000, to basically December 2003, up at Athol Springs. Likes repel, but unlikes attract. Kilohertz. The somnambulist state, a sleep-like trance leading to extreme lucidity, cosmic consciousness, mystical wisdom. The ear, doubly mysterious. probes seeking each other's small magnets of the trunk, avoiding the terrestrial and celestial poles. Freud, 1904. Then would it not appear strange if this person in turn influences a second, just as a magnetized piece of soft iron acquired the property of attracting a second? Le Baquet at Athol Springs. Fearful. Calmer. And repose. And now we'll go into the atrium. A manifestation of love, a passionale attraction. Now, I really regret that you didn't hear the sounds of the people at Athol Springs, but if you go in later to the other room, you can hear some of it in the installation. What I'm going to show you now are photographs that I took at a quarry during an annual fall outing in northern Canada. You may notice that in some rituals, guests wear traditional caps and white socks. Healing can be achieved through simplicity of dress. This was this was in fall 2001. Looking for manganite. Psychic phenomenon not understood. Mysteriously, a sign of infinity appeared in the dunes. Their exercises completed for the day, the Harmonites have left. Now, I think we have enough time for me to read a couple of case histories. I have permission to do this to the small audience, and I think you may find it interesting to hear some of what's written down after the treatments, after the patients have left. This case history was written in March 2000, actually, and it's about a Mrs. G. Ms. G, rather. Ms. G sought out treatment because of her inability to make decisions. She was ambivalent, obsessive, and could not imagine her future life. Throughout the interview, she talked only in the third person. She began, "This story is called The Tornado." She came from a town in Florida that was devastated by a tornado. Like all tornadoes, the storm took a narrow path, veering this way and that way, destroying her house, but leaving the houses on either side intact. Her neighbors were fine. Their houses were standing. Her family, though, had died in their bedrooms while she was out shopping for peaches. She grieved and grieved. Her friends surrounded and loved her. She moved to a different town in a vain effort to suppress painful memories. On a walk one day, she came upon a dog, about 6 years of age, injured on the road. Judging from his glazed eyes, shallow breathing, lolling tongue, he looked mortally wounded. Nevertheless, she called for help, rescued him, and paid for his treatment. He had many fractures, internal injuries, but she knew. He had many fractures, internal injuries, and she nursed him for nearly 2 years. In constant pain, the dog never seemed grateful, but she knew he was. Right before he died, he said, "Tell me 3 wishes. I will grant them to you." And she said, "Sex first, then love or death." Several years later, she met Sex. He was a nice-looking foreign man. He played the bass. He played with his fingers and thumbs and the base of his thumb. He strummed and plucked the bass, and they made music in the key of D. She played him like an oboe, his instrument in high school in the key of E. Their music was high, the two instruments coming together and then apart. The next time Sex visited her, it was in the form of a goat who faced her while rearing up on his hind legs. His small, white, fur-colored pate was a blur of constant motion. Coarse white hairs sprouted from his plump belly and balls. His appetite was keen, and they played on and on, always together. The music was symphonic, lasting through many movements. She seemed to be meeting many more animals than humans, and finally settled on a rabbit with baby blue, very round eyes and an open, inviting mien. His fur was soft and smooth to the touch. He was strong. For a short and slight rabbit with a thin frame, narrow chest, but ample muscles in the fore and hindquarters. His member was large and got stiff in a wink. But he was so excited all of the time that in pursuing some shoots, he got lost in the woods and, being bewildered, couldn't find his way back. Now all of that was over. She agonized. Had the time come for the next wish? She didn't know, and hence she came to the new society. And what would that wish be? Love or death, love or death. We recommended a course of magnetic somnambulism, then work on the larger machines, and a day in the atrium. She would see Mesmer once a week. At the end of her stay, no longer ambivalent, she had come to a realization. The answer to her question was, whatever comes first. And one more. A little later, this was from a patient who left the society in July 2000, actually. And Dr. Mesmer calls this the color white. Mrs. H is a 47-year-old divorced woman who came to the society for counseling after the death of her aunt. She was tall, slender, and exceedingly graceful. She was dressed in a white wool suit, and her feet were adorned in white shoes that had small hourglass-shaped heels. Around her neck was a single strand of pearls. Her stockings were white, her handbag was white. Her fingernails were painted white, transparent at the base of the nail, and opaque at the tip. But her fastidiousness, her physical perfection, contrasted with her hair, which was short, of a reddish-brown tint, brushed back boldly, revealing white roots. as if she were letting it go and proud of it. She spoke profusely, fluently, unhesitatingly, without a break, revealing a state of unrelenting excitation. After listening to her for part of an hour, it became clear that after her aunt's death, she became obsessed with the color white. "White was drawn out of me like a thread," she said. She relayed the details. "My cousin called to tell me that my aunt had died. The funeral was set for Tuesday at 10:30 a.m. in Yonkers, near where she lived. I took the 9:15 a.m. train out of New York City to Spoutin-Deauville, which is closer to my cousin's house. It was a typical November morning, the temperature around 40 degrees, the sky overcast, a light gray. The train tracks hugged the banks of the Hudson River, and the station itself, red brick, sits at the bottom of an escarpment. I waited there for him, looking up at the brown and gray rocks and cliff. He drove up in an old white Cadillac, a wreck. The license plate hung loose on a wire. The car had a million dents and scratches, and the fenders were rusted through. I hadn't seen him since high school, but my cousin had the same long face and bloodshot eyes, and when he smiled, big reddish gums. He is a large man, very bent over. How sad. We drove a few blocks to the funeral home, which was white-painted brick, and waited there at the entrance for his brother, my other cousin, the shorter, handsome one, the athlete who arrived shortly in his car, a new Jaguar, polished, waxed and white. We walked in together, and the director ushered us into a corner room that was empty except for a couple of rows of white plastic chairs. There she was. The white casket was open from the back of the room. All you could see was her white hair, curled and fluffed up, but nothing else. After a while, the room filled up with neighbors, friends, and a few other relatives. Then Reverend Simpson, quite an eloquent speaker, read from a sermon about the seasons to soothe us. He said, "The trees are left naked, gray-black skeletons of death, prepared now staunchly to wait out a long, drab winter. Weeks pass. The world pierces the barrier of death and emerges white, pure white, everywhere. The landscape is transformed, graced with an unexpected, undreamed purity." I interrupted her. "Yes, the barrier of death. I understand your grief. Your aunt, you loved her." She was silent for a moment, and then she blurted, "She was my father's sister. I never had a relationship with her. She always seemed so needy and so repressed, so I never really had the courage. I have courage in a lot of other things, but not with her. The week after the funeral, I went to the dentist to have my teeth whitened. Then I had my toenails and fingernails painted white. I changed my stationery from cream to ivory. The week after that, I threw out my underwear and bought everything white. I bought a couch upholstered in Egyptian cotton, a linen rug, and a set of white leather chairs. I had my walls repainted the color seed pearl. I've been eating yogurt with bananas. Only the insides of baked potatoes, sole, halibut, chili and sea bass, celery root with mayonnaise, and white bread. I drink Sprite and Chardonnay, and for dessert, always coconut ice cream." And here's Dr. Mesmer's fascinating response. "To free her of her obsession, I launched into a talking cure. I said, 'You are obsessed with the color white.' I isolated the colors, the letters, W-H-I-T-E, and repeated aloud three times, W-H-I-T-E, W-H-I-T-E, W-H-I-T-E. I explained the derivation of the word white, the old English wheat, wheat, queed, to shine, wheat, becoming, and queet, white, in the Centum languages. Then we analyzed white according to the law of physics by examining painted squares of red, yellow, and blue, together and then separately. I offered an anecdote about Chekhov, hoping to stimulate a healing synesthesia. Not long before he died, Chekhov wrote a letter to a friend. 'You ask me what life is like asking what a carrot is. A carrot is a carrot and nothing more. We know that specific brain regions process information about different things. Thus, there are areas for colors, edges, motion, faces, body parts, nouns, verbs, and so on. A color area like white may lie next to an area that handles metaphysical concepts. I speculated that if these regions were more strongly connected, they might fire simultaneously, giving rise to insight. But the talking cure was to no avail. We offered her magnetic color therapy to realign her poles. In the presence of a full spectrum of colors, I grasped her thumbs, one on each hand, and held them until I perceived an equal degree of magnetic heat between my thumb and hers. This treatment was repeated each time she came to the clinic, once for a month and then twice monthly. Surprisingly, her condition was unchanged. She was still dressed in white and was still obsessed. She came to the clinic less and less frequently and eventually stopped coming altogether. Many months later, we received a letter from her. She was living in Acapulco. Dr. Mesmer, greetings from Acapulco. I've been here for 2 months. I've fallen in love with a Mexican man. His name is Lazarus, pronounced Lazaro. When he was young, he dived off the cliffs for a living. Now he works as a tour guide. I met him one evening on the beach. I was wearing my new bathing suit, ultra white. All I saw was his coffee-colored skin and shiny brown hair. I went home with him, and he stripped for me while standing on a table. We spent an hour in his jacuzzi. We kissed and kissed. He said, give it to me, baby, I know you can. He gave me a bruise on my nipple. It turned crimson, then plum, and by the third day it was the color of a Concord grape. For the fourth day, for breakfast, I ate some fruit. I broke an egg and fried it. The yellow stood round and firm. I ate that too, and afterwards I had some orange juice. I'm extremely thrilled to welcome Catherine, who's come down from Athol Springs, and she's asked if she can demonstrate a daily ritual at the new society. It is a real privilege to be able to do this, and she will just fill you in on some of the things that I haven't been able to do. So welcome, Catherine. Thank you so much for coming down to Philadelphia. Thank you.
Opportunity after Lenore's lovely introduction to the work that we do at Athol Springs to familiarize you or introduce you to the physical side of the work we do, because really our work doesn't exist outside of the physical realm. Our work is about how to get in touch with yourself, with the people around you, with the terrestrial realm, with the sappy juices of the plants, with the celestial orbs. So I'd like to introduce you to the personal fortification process. Mesmer asked, how does one fortify himself? And the answer is, he throws his arms behind his head, wide and open. This is where fortification begins, behind the eyes and through the fingertips. So I'd like to invite you to participate in this with me. Everybody could stand up, please. Thank you. And as you do this, I'll demonstrate, but pay attention to the harmony that begins to build inside you, between you and your neighbor, and within the room. So again, how does one fortify himself? He throws his arms behind his head, wide and open. Fortification begins here, behind the eyes and out through the fingertips. So please participate with me. Thank you.
Thank you, Catherine.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming down. It was just really wonderful that you came.
Thank you.
Okay. Whoops, I'm being mic'd here.
I want to thank Lenore again for coming to New York, and I'd like to invite you to stay for the opening to follow.